Mr. Wright.
I find this House Bill 50 commendable. However, I want to draw the committee's attention to page 4, section 4, wherein it states that this 1971 Act does not apply to, number one, conduct in compliance with the orders or rules of or a statute administered by a federal, state, or local governmental agency. Now,
I didn't pick up the line yet. Would you give the line number?
24. Line 24.
I'm with you.
Section 4, line 24. Now, I seriously question the wisdom in making any exclusions to this act. First of all, we have equal protection under the law. We don't want to discriminate, actually, against any industry. The wording of this bill, the way it is worded, trade and commerce means the advertising, offering for sale, or distribution of any services or any property, tangible or intangible, real, personal, or mixed, or any other article, commodity, or thing of value, wherever situated, and include any trade or commerce directly or indirectly affecting the people of the state. Now, I see no reason why this bill could not be applicable to the business of insurance, the business of real estate, or any other business conducted in this state. Now, to allow for these exclusions, we would have to have a very strong presumption that these other industries are equally as well regulated. And I would consider such an assumption as completely erroneous. Now, I would like to further advocate, and it is my understanding that possibly this bill might not be passed because it would require an appropriation, creating a new department. It would be my suggestion that the funds already appropriated to these various agencies, such as the insurance commissioner, the corporation commissioner, the real estate commissioner, the liquor commissioner, and all of these other commissioners, all of these funds, if they were total and added up to what their expenditures already are, I haven't done so, but I feel confident that there is enough money already spent at this administrative level to be applied to this new agency under the Attorney General. Now, there are other good and valid reasons for making this suggestion. First of all, our administrative agencies, such as the Department of Insurance, Real Estate Commissioner, and agencies such as this, these agencies have what you would call quasi-judicial authority. And, of course, they sit in judgment at administrative hearings. Now, I'm going to say this out of personal knowledge. I find that most of these agencies, in sitting in judgment and on quasi-judicial authority, are totally incompetent to preside over such matters. In other words, they do not have the background or the training in law. And as a result of that, the majority of their decisions, when contested, are reversed. And I feel, strongly feel, that if we are going to regulate commerce and regulate it in this state without discrimination, equally, that all commerce should be subjected to this bill with prosecution by the Attorney General. Now, I have had this experience in the past, and it goes back clean into the time of Governor Mark Hatfield. If you will recall in the 64 hearings on the subject of insurance, the legislative findings of fact at those hearings held that the insurance industry had not been regulated during the terms of several commissioners back. And I have personal knowledge and evidence to the effect that it is not regulated today. We have the laws, but they are not being enforced. And for that reason, I believe it was Robert Wyatt Thornton who published in the Salem Statesman in response to a letter that I had written to the editor. He stated as Attorney General that he did not have the authority to act against insurers for fraudulent misrepresentations, that that authority had to come from the governor. And I would assume that if he is correct in that statement, that our present Attorney General would also not have the authority to act against the fraudulent misrepresentations of the life insurance industry. Now, this bill, as a statute, would give the Attorney General the authority that he needed to act against fraud, regardless of what industry or where it came from. Now, I find nothing in this bill that would not be applicable to the business of insurance, even to the extent of Section 5, where it is intended, due consideration shall be given to the interpretation of the Federal Trade Commission and the federal courts. Now, of course, our insurance industry is a creature of the federal government, in that through the Act of March 9, 1945, the state was given the right to regulate the business of insurance. However, there were several exclusions to that act. The Sherman Act, as to coercion, intimidation, and boycott, were not affected by the Act of March 9, 1945. Also, the Act specifically stated that the right to regulate the industry did not extend to any scheme to accomplish a forbidden result, nor did it extend to any purpose or reason that was not of legitimate interest to the state. Now, in my opinion, this bill would only be acceptable to me if it applied to all of industry without exception. And I find that if there were exceptions and exclusions, that it would be a discriminatory application of the law, because the insurance division has not yet advocated that they adopt all federal consumer legislation. Now, we have had numerous federal consumer legislation, Truth in Lending, things of this nature, that should be applicable to the business of insurance in this state, but have never been applied. Now, this bill would bring those provisions under all of this industry, and yet here we have the insurance industry sitting out here, and they're only subject to our insurance code, which I find to be, to actually have the ultimate effect of a monopoly, because there is absolutely no competition in the business of insurance. And I feel that this bill, if it were adopted to the insurance industry, would eliminate that position. Now, this isn't my own personal opinion. I'm sure that most of you realize that there have been at least 20 books written by knowledgeable authors implying that the insurance industry is the biggest legalized racket in America today. And I feel that I can prove that. And for that reason, I think that if the people who are sponsoring this bill, if they can't advocate that it also apply to the business of insurance, then I would like to personally know their reasons why not.
Any questions, Mr. Wright?
I'm in the insurance business. I sell life insurance. But I would very much like to be proud of having that license. And I can't be proud of it until this industry is regulated in accordance to the law. And I feel that if this state doesn't soon regulate it, they're going to lose that right. Because you have to assume that Congress granted the right to regulate the business, and it follows that any time that there is a right to regulate, there is a corresponding right to enforce it.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Wright, one question. You apparently are unhappy with the way the present laws that govern the insurance business are being handled. Now, what makes you think that this law here would be administered enough better to correct the problem? Do you want to put your finger on what's the problem with the present situation?
Well, it's right on the front page. This brings this under the Attorney General's and the District Attorney's office. Right now, under your insurance code, there is too much discretionary authority granted to the insurance commissioner. Entirely too much. Under the present law, if it were enacted in accordance to the law, felonies that are considered crimes that normally would be prosecuted by the Attorney General's office are attempted to be prosecuted by the insurance department. Now, he has a great deal, or at least he feels he has, a great deal of discretion along these lines. As a result of the 1964 hearings on insurance, a certain type of policy was completely outlawed in this state. Now, there is evidence right here in the Salem courthouse to the effect that insurance companies have violated that provision. They have been selling profit-sharing policies in the state after the enactment of that law. But it still remains a fact, gentlemen, that never in the history of this state has this state ever taken action against any insurance company for the violation of the insurance code. Now, why? Is it because they're perfect little angels? No, that's not the question. The 64 hearings showed that they weren't. The 64 hearings showed that the industry was misrepresenting their product to the public, and that the industry had not been regulated during the terms of several commissioners back, and our present commissioner has not made any changes in that attitude. Now, why should I, as a layman, have to proceed in the circuit courts, issuing writs of mandamus against the Director of Commerce and the Insurance Commissioner, as well as the governor himself, trying to force a duty to regulate the insurance department?
How many cases do you have pending?
Right now I have three. I have three tort actions against the state for malicious prosecution. I have an action before a three-judge federal court that will be argued this Tuesday. And in that court I'm challenging numerous of the insurance laws of the state of Oregon as being misrepresentations themselves. I have alleged that they're nothing more than sales aids for con artists to continue to fleece the public. And all of this in this bill here, House Bill 50, as to misleading words, statements, or phrases would be applicable. Now, we have them in the unfair trade practice section of the insurance code, but they're not enforced. And I can give you a very vivid illustration. What is an insurance policy dividend? Most people don't know. They feel that it's the same as a share in a stock. But there is a difference. And if you care to look it up in words and phrases, you'll find at least 10 pages in there defining the word dividend, the general, ordinary meaning of the word. It's an earning. It's a profit. Something that's the result of an investment. Now, you'll also find in words and phrases the meaning of the word insurance policy dividend. And the one thing that stands out there, gentlemen, is that an insurance policy dividend is, in fact, not a dividend at all. The word is a total and complete misnomer. So why is the industry using it, when it is against the law to use words, statements, and phrases that are misleading? The question is, is it misleading or not? It is the misrepresentation of this one word that brought on about the hearings in 1964 and caused the outlawing of the profit-sharing contract. But they didn't eliminate the source of the misrepresentation. There is no reason for the industry to use this word, because there's absolutely nothing in an insurance policy that could be righteously called a dividend. Your federal definition is that it is not a true dividend.
And Chairman, are we getting a little far afield from the bill?
Your question been answered?
Yes, my question was answered several minutes ago.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, Senator Lawrence, you and you have your proposed amendment.
Madam Chairman, I have it in two forms. First of all, I have the amendment in amendment form. Second of all, I have them in cut and paste form. So I think it's easy to follow the cut and paste form. I wonder if Dave and Mr. O'Leary could join.
You want to talk to
the table? Yeah. let me, if I might, make a preliminary statement about these amendments, and then I propose to go.
I think I'll leave Pete on because I have a vote for me. I may want to refer to
then let Mr. O'Leary make a preliminary statement, and then I propose to go through the amendments as a group, and then come back to them one at a time for whatever consideration you want to give them. First of all, just by way of preliminary statement, I met with Mr. O'Leary, also the attorney for
Sears,
Ms. Ayers, and with Bernard, Dave Shannon, and myself. We met for about 3+ hours yesterday. We met for another hour, and I left, and probably some more time after that. These are an attempt on my part to meet, insofar as I think possible and appropriate, the objections raised by Mr. O'Leary in his testimony before the committee. These are not presented as joint amendments on his behalf and on my behalf, and he reserves the right to oppose the bill, but I think he will advise you that he thinks these amendments are go a long way to the position that he represents. I wonder if he might want to make a general statement. I'll go through the amendments.
I would appreciate making a general statement. Let me pass out to Senator Wilner has a copy of these, and pardon the quality of the copy. These are the amendments that we gave to Senator Wilner. I think we've advised it will come out just right.
Yeah.
These are the ones that we gave Senator Wilner for SB 50. I have here copies of the amendments with comments, which are, for the most part, substantively similar, where the provisions are parallel for HB 1088. As Senator mentioned, we did meet. While we don't see eye to eye on each provision, I feel that he has either specifically or substantively met the bulk of our objections, and his amendments will yield what honestly has to be termed a generally balanced piece of legislation, balancing the interests of consumers and legitimate business. I think our major reservation relates to the class action provisions. We realize that there are arguments in favor of class actions. I won't burden you with the dissertation of class actions as I did last time. In the SB 50 amendments, which are the thermofax copies that we gave to Senator Wilner, we started with a suggestion that the class action provision be deleted, which is our basically unalterable position. However, we did submit along with that our suggestions of class action management and protection provisions, which is attached to the back of the first three pages of numbered amendments. These are our opinion of what class action should contain. Senator Wilner and Dave Shannon worked quite hard and worked out some alternative suggestions, which there'll be suggestions here, which do offer some reasonable protections. We would prefer to see some of the language, more of the language from ours than there in there, but we think that they've done a generally honest and balanced job. Actually met substantive many of our objections, with the exception of our basic premise in regard to class actions that we oppose. But as he goes through the amendments, you'll see, compared to the comments I made last week, that he reaches substantively to the bulk of our amendments. Right? On a balanced bill, we feel that we also feel that the Attorney General's Bill HB 1088, with the amendments that we submitted to it, is a bill that we would support. It doesn't have the class action provision, and it does have the creation of the Consumer Protection Division in that bill, which we favor that division. No further comments.
Now I'm supposed to go through the amendments, explain them as we go along, and suggest that the simple thing might be just take 5 minutes, go through all of them, and then come back to them one at a time. And in 5 minutes, I kind of summarize the whole pattern. Or you refer to them just one at a time. And I said you have in front of you amendments in proper form that will accomplish each of these. All right, the first one I think is essentially not controversial. It just says that the district court, a small claims court, a justice court, may also be a court which these matters may be heard. This is particularly important in connection with the private lawsuits that might be filed under this bill. I don't know if that's controversial.
I think it's a good amendment.
All right, then, did you want to act on these or what?
No, I don't think there's any point in acting on them separately. But some of these proposals of Mr. O'Leary's, if they're on a page, and he has any comment, make it while we're on that page. Okay?
Surely. I will make comments with the amendments where appropriate. It won't be very many.
All right. You have one proposed on this page, but indicated earlier it's a minor one.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
Now, the next thing on page 3, the next amendment you'll find is line 5. Mr. O'Leary suggests taking out the words unfair methods of competition and we've taken those words out. This makes it, I think rightly pointed out, that this is not a bill to protect other businesses, it's a bill to protect consumers.
Any questions now?
No, I'm
happy. You have questions?
The next one on line 19, I think, again, Mr. O'Leary suggested just some clarifying language. I think it's clearer that if they are not, rather than listing the alternative, that I think is almost better style, really.
If they are not,
it represents a good there is on new. If they are not, it's kind of more all-inclusive than saying if they are deteriorated, all the reconditioned reclaimed used are secondhand. I think that's a stylistic change.
You don't need the word new again? I presume it's redundant.
I had to read it twice before I knew what you meant. The way it is.
Well,
I got it.
Representing good your original or new if they are not new.
If they're not original or new, I suppose you'd have to say it's your
not
original or new, then. That's a style. Oh, all right. The next one, here again, I think this is another suggestion where line 30, where we had said, unless the advertisement discloses the limitation of quantity, and a suggestion was made just stopping after disclosing the limitation, in which case the language is more inclusive. And here I think Mr. O'Leary suggests something which makes it fairer.
Question here, what other things besides quantity come into this?
Generally, in quantity, I think that what with concept of ingenuity that people fear in the marketplace, the person you could have a disclosure of a false limitation of quantity, which arguably wouldn't violate J as written.
we get down to the first two matters of some substance. If you recall, the first, I think, major point that Mr. O'Leary made in connection with this list of deceptive practices was that he didn't want a businessman to be innocently committing a deceptive practice. And we have written the language in number three, paste in, here, which says, it shall be a defense to an action brought under Section 3 of this Act that the fellow neither had knowledge nor with the exercise of reasonable care would have known that he was engaging in acts prohibited by this section. This language is roughly parallel to the language in the existing Oregon law, which has been there since 1967. Let me talk about the other one because they relate. Also, Mr. O'Leary objected particularly to items P and Q. If you look them on lines 11 through 14 of page 4, because they were, he felt more difficult for a businessman to easily determine what was lawful and what was unlawful. In other words, they're kind of catch-alls. Like P is engaging in any other conduct which similarly creates a likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding, and Q is engaging in any act or practice which is unfair or deceptive to the consumer. So, attempting to meet his objection, we've put in the new number 4. For no action shall be brought under subsection P and Q or subsection 1 of section 3 unless the Attorney General has first established a rule or regulation under section 5 of this Act declaring the practice to be unfair or deceptive to the consumer. Then I think we better cross-reference to the top of page 5 and consider that with this, where we had given the Attorney General power to make rules or regulations, technical. But the new language, in accordance with the procedures of ORS Chapter 183. So essentially what that means, put together, is that the Attorney General may, if he wish, suggest rules or regulations defining P and Q. And they are subject to all the procedural safeguards of Chapter 183, which is hearing, notice, and the possibility of a court declaratory judgment if the result is illegal. So by adding 4 along with this language on the top of page 5, you make it specific what the P and Q is with a due process procedure for getting there. And yet you allow the Attorney General to define practices which otherwise would be weaved around the other language. I think that's what I want to say about those three in a package.
On this point, I just quickly say that we still object to the P&Q objection to the omnibus clause. However, the subsection 4 and in relation to section 5.2 modifies the substance of our objection and reaches toward the substance of our objection on the omnibus clauses and certainly mitigates our problem.
John, if you delete both those sections, how much are you weakening?
Could I yield to Dave on that, Mr. Chairman? Dave's the guy who has been forcing us when I had a first mistake. I can give you some examples of situations where people are ingenious enough to get around this.
One of the questions that's come up, particularly in the field of franchising, which we do not now have any regulation on, but is the sale of a product where you make investment up to $5,000 or $10,000, is income expectation. We don't have anything about that. The guy says, hey, you make $11,000 in 5 days, you're talking about a future fact. Now, it ought to have some kind of relationship to past action. I'm befuddled how I'm going to catch that one under present act. And this kind of thing would give an opportunity. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has brought actions against companies doing this kind of thing under their general section, which is unfair and deceptive practice. And now we have decisions on their part or proposed rules under their FTC suggesting that this is unfair and deceptive, that it's a misrepresentation as to income expectation. I would consider this as an example that might come under here where the Attorney General would hold a hearing on this, giving people notice, and then present the question as to what kind of restrictions there are in this field. And as I said, I don't think we can cover it right now.
You have a question?
Yes, I was wondering, I'm a little bit in the dark as to just exactly how much the Attorney General is going to be allowed to do. We're not giving him carte blanche to go ahead and write to, you know, substantive changes in this thing with this. He has to relate them all back to what we have already spelled out. Is that the protection there?
I would read as to number P. They would have to relate to the A through O, since it talked about similarly. I think number Q is broader, but number Q would still have to meet the task of being unfair or deceptive and be subject to, first of all, the hearing procedure, and second of all, the declaratory judgment procedure of a court attesting it.
The proposed legislation from the Federal Trade Commission has this section in it, and it's the kind of language that would relate, very closely back to your Federal Trade Commission's proceedings.
You might look at the section 5 sub 1 at the bottom of that page and on the top of the next page, suggesting FTC interpretations as being a relevant guide.
Okay, Mr. Larry, you were concerned about the unknowing merchant, but you've gotten into subsection 3 here, right? I think that subsection 3 reaches to the subsection 3 reaches the substance of many of the objections I made, yeah. Unknowing merchant, etc., in other places, all right. You'll notice that in the list of amendments to the Senator and also to the House Judiciary Committee, our suggested language for what would be Section 4, Sub 2, starting line 26, page 4, is included. I don't see any point going through the amendments that I submitted for negotiation with Senator Wilmer. He didn't suggest it. So.
The next one on page 5, line 13, is just eliminating a redundancy. Existing law covers that. That such order, then injunction shall be issued to that body.
Okay, mm-hmm.
All right, then on line 22. Now, here we have a policy difference. We had originally, at the present Oregon law, does not have. I'm sorry, did I miss one?
Yes.
Forgive me. Underneath the, I missed. I don't think it's controversial, but on page 4, line 24, adding the words or regulation. I think that is a redundancy, and again, this is in line with the consumer bill, not a bill to protect competitors. Forgive me for that. I think the next one of substance is line 22, page 5. Our present law does not provide that the prosecuting attorney give any advance warning to the person that he is proceeding against at all. We had proposed in this bill advance notice of 7 days for service of investigative demands. Seven days for notifying the person of the alleged deceptive trade practice and the relief to be sought. In this situation, it's fair, for example, to a person who, a large company that may have only a branch office on the ground and may wish to communicate with the home office. So that's an additional protection that's not provided by present law. We had said 7. Prentice and his proposal said 30. We suggest 10.
Are you happy?
It's a matter of preference and convenience as opposed to dire need.
Our feeling that 10 days, question is how much time it takes for the branch office to notify the home office, and some of them are fairly bureaucratic, but it was our feeling that if they were told that Dave Shannon is, or equivalent is after them, within 10 days they could prepare their views on the matter. We thought it.
John, let me answer David's question here. If you give notice that you're going to file a suit, and there is some place later in the bill here where you can take some action if you expect there's going to be...
Next paragraph. The notwithstanding provision.
Oh, all right.
All right, then the next one is on section 9 on page 6. Where now notice section 9 deals only with orders once the practice has been declared to be unlawful. In other words, here we're getting to the remedy after the adjudication has been made. And we suggest that the appointment of a receiver or the revocation of a license as a technique of restoring the money to persons who were victimized after the court made the finding. You'll notice after the practice appeared to be unlawful. We agree with Prentice that the revocation of the license is too extreme a remedy, and we have limited the appointment of a receiver in those situations to the situations where there's an urgent need to move. And this is fairly similar to the normal circumstances in which a receiver is appointed under present law. And this, again, I hope meets the objection that he was concerned with.
I think he does.
Yeah. All right, then on section 11, now we get to the problem of class action. And let me emphasize that the tenets of O'Leary and his client's position is that they're opposed to class action. Without waiving or diminishing his opposition to class action, he has suggested to us some ways of making it more palatable if we insist on having class action. We have carefully gone over the language that he has proposed, and since his language a little longer. This is based primarily on a combination of Massachusetts and California class action statutes, which are existing law in other states. Now, let me just outline basically what we're talking about. His first concern, and a very major concern expressed the other day, was that he had no real objection to the $200 as being minimum damages if one individual sued. And that's in section 11, paragraph 1, line 6. But he thought it would be grossly unfair if there was a class action and the class prevailed and the $200 minimum damages provided for the entire class. We accept that and have written in the words actual damages, you see, which appears on line 14. All right, then this long insert essentially defines a procedure. Now, the first part of the procedure is essentially giving advance warning to the company that's about to be sued, stating what the complaint is, and giving the company 30 days to meet it. Think of this in terms of a situation where maybe a branch office of a company, a branch manager has done something he shouldn't have done. Example in our conversations or maybe a bad bait and switch operation. And when it's brought to the attention of the home office, they say, that's wrong. We're firing the branch manager. That still doesn't provide remedies for the aggrieved consumers. But it's a good example of the kind of situation where a responsible company in that situation should have the opportunity of meeting the problem in a correct way before they're faced with a lawsuit. That's essentially what we're getting at in this 30 days warning to them, during which time they've got a right to take restitutionary action if they wish. All right, then also as part of that, and if their restitutionary action is offered and it's not accepted by the plaintiff, and if a lawsuit is filed, and the plaintiff does not get any more than was tendered, the plaintiff cannot pyramid cost and attorney fees. That's the protection.
Well, now, wait a minute. On that point, though, if he can get $200 for actual damages, whichever is greater.
In the first paragraph. The second paragraph is the class action paragraph.
That's the individual. Right. But in the class action, they can still get that, right?
No. Class action, only actual damages. If one person sues, he can get the $200 and they don't worry. That's not their concern. Their concern is the multiple plaintiff problem. All right, so that's the first thing that these...
Let me get a question on this. Couldn't you evade the class action thing and make it more profitable for, say you had 100 people here and each one sued separately, as long as they can get $200 plus their attorney's cost, the first guy's proved they can do it. Wouldn't they end up possibly costing the same thing as a class action, and actually they have to go through the motions, of course?
Don't we have some language that they force our attorneys to language?
Yes, that would be...
On individual fees, what is that?
That would be question four.
I think part of the problem is being buoyed by the fact that if someone went out in that type of situation, you'd have to recruit his client.
It's not
as soon as you
like. I can see it as an unscrupulous lawyer saying, "Oh boy, I've really got something. I've won this case, and oh boy, there must be thousands more of the same thing."
Except if it gets in the newspaper, the report of the
first one.
Of the first one, then others who purchased.
Yeah. Don't we have to turn the language on section one?
Yes, we do.
And is that
it's section four. I don't see it posted in here. The attorney's fees are provided in section seven, the new amended section seven.
So we have covered.
And it says...
it's not pasted in here.
No, it's not.
For some reason,
I don't know what.
For some reason, we do not have a paste-in on section seven. And we...
Subsection seven never says that.
Yes, but that can be struck.
Will you read the language, David, and tell them where it goes?
That's our error.
We do have some material that covers, but I'm not going to get to what you're getting at. Which is in your amendment.
In any action, this is section 7. And it was, in any action brought by a person under this section, the court may, in addition to the relief provided in this section, award a reasonable attorney's fees and costs if the following conditions are met. One, notice is given to the alleged violator of this act 10 days prior to the commencement of the action of this section. Such notice shall contain the alleged violation, the amount of damages sustained, the demand for damages be paid, or the transaction be rescinded. B, the defendant refused the plaintiff's demand or did not respond within 10 days to receive notice. C, that if the alleged violator of this act tenders an offer prior to the commencement of this action and the person bringing the action refuses the offer, that the person bringing the action must be awarded greater damages than the offer tendered.
I think it's in front of you in the printed amendment. Now, let me just describe what that... Dave, what page is it on in the amendment?
Next to the last page
of the printed amendment. Page...
We don't have
that.
That's
good. No, you have this.
No, we don't.
No, you each have one of my amendments. I thought you did. Sure.
No, doesn't look like yours.
Here, let's try these.
I don't
here it is. Here it is. This is page...
Oh, no, I've got it.
Here it is. Here, buddy. Page 5 of the printed amendments. For some reason, we don't have these pasted in. Let me just describe what these do. At the present time, Hector, in Oregon,
starts back here.
Yeah. At the present time in Oregon law, may I go ahead and show you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Present time in Oregon law, there are two situations that come readily to mind where a plaintiff can get attorney's fees in addition to his actual damages. One is a suit for property damage in a tort case or damage case under $1,000. And the other is a suit on an insurance policy, suing your own insurance company. In both those situations, they have analogous provisions where you must make advance demand and be rejected.
And prosecution, if it's possible.
And our attorney's fees proper. So this is like, actually this language is something that Dave and I dreamed up in our concern for members of the Retail Trade Bureau, which even Prentice didn't find. It's a good provision. And so does he.
So fine.
Well, I think that will get it.
Looks like you've taken care of it.
I think. But anyway, let me go back to the class thing. The first thing was the opportunity of doing right before the suit is filed. That covers all of number three. All right, then number four deals with a preliminary hearing. Now, the conditions here are conditions that the court must find before the suit can go forward. In other words, before the defendant company is put to the burden of defending on the merits against all of the claim fraud. This is a preliminary hearing which establishes if it's appropriate for a class action to go forward. And so the court must find, if you look on the second page, that the class representative suit is more appropriate individual actions. The members of the class are Oregon residents or the alleged wrongful acts occurred in the state of Oregon. That's to make sure that somebody doesn't file suit in court in Linn County and on behalf of all residents of Alaska, Idaho, North Carolina, and Linn County. Questions of law or fact common to the class substantially similar, predominantly over questions affecting individual members. That's again just a way of saying that it's a true class action. You know, we do have an identity of interest, really. Number four, the class can be reasonably identified and limited so as not to make the class unmanageable nor damages indefinite. Prentice is rightfully worried about apparently some suits been filed in California was one file on behalf of all citizens of the United States. Not quite.
All citizens of the state of California.
This would allow a court to rule out that kind of a... Then five, provisions for notice to the members of the class. And this is important because the members of the class are bound by it, you see, so they must have notice. Then, at the next page, number C, this is taking the language of the so-called defense of mistake, the same language we had previously, section 3, and saying that the businessman can, if he proves it's a mistake, that he's got a defense. And the important part of C is that it allows him to establish that in a preliminary hearing before he has to go through the whole long hearing and the ultimate case. Or that he can establish with a bona fide error as set forth here, that's the end of it right there. And other things that's set forth there. And then five provides that the court retains control of the class. This is important because the charge is sometimes made that when class suits are filed, that the original class often is charged in minority stockholders. Where the minority stockholders in the business of filing these kinds of suits and seeks to get bought off in some of the benefit to him rather than benefit to the class as a whole. So once the suit is filed, the whole thing is under the control of the court and the court can ensure equity. Now, this kind of, well, Silicon Valley want to be heard on this, but this goes to the substance of his concerns about class action, remembering he's opposed to it.
Right.
And is based largely on Massachusetts and California existing law. I think he may want to comment on that.
My comment comes down to, as indicated in our suggested amendments here, we are opposed to class action for the reasons I set forth last week. The attachment includes the same theory of the numerous of the protections senators inserted here. Not all of them, exactly the same language put forth. Theory is there, substance is there. Problem first, he's been doing word here and there, and all in all, they reach. A number of the technical protection management questions that we raised, but we still feel that class actions are inappropriate and inefficient remedy in these types of acts. This is a technical comment. I would think that in your C, on 4C, which is on page 3, is that your preliminary hearing should go to the acceptability of the restitutionary cure tendered by the alleged violator prior to the suit, without getting into the merits necessarily. Now, this was, as they indicated, derived from Massachusetts and California, and I think it's back on page 1 or 3, it's derived primarily from Massachusetts. I think California notice demand restitutionary cure opportunity section is clear, provides more definite standards, and would affect a more efficient recovery for consumers than does the Massachusetts style that's adapted by Mr. Shannon, Senator.
Let me ask you a question. I assume under this language that you're able to at least get some kind of testimony and evidence and so on for a defense.
It would appear that way.
What if the judge denies this and says, no, there's plenty of evidence here for our case? Can that be used in the trial that the judge has refused already based upon...
Do you have a copy of the California Division?
Would that prejudice the court at the trial?
It looked to me like this is kind of a segregated issue is really what it is. In other words, in a trial of a lawsuit, suppose, let me put it in other terms, the plaintiff filed a suit for personal injuries, claimed his leg was cut off wrongfully, and the insurance company replies, you released that claim when we paid you $4 for it. Often the court will say that segregated issue of the validity of that release shall be tried first, before the whole trial is held on the question of the merits of whether he was entitled to recover from a sawn-off leg. And if that issue is tried first, and if the release is held to be invalid, then you go ahead with the remainder trial. If the release is held to be invalid, that's the end of it. My thought here is to allow the defendant to try at his preliminary hearing the segregated issue of bona fide mistake without subjecting to the entire trial. Now, if there are two ways of looking at this, one is that is a complete trial on that issue, which would be binding later on. The The other way is kind of the preliminary showing approach. I had meant first, but maybe David wanted to.
If I may, the Massachusetts Act, I do know, doesn't have a statement as to evidence that any offer of settlement currently cannot be admitted. And you could put a provision in like that. I would think the court. I would consider this like a demur, you know, just for the purposes of this settlement, we're admitting that the major thing is he's admitting that this was a deceptive act. Now let's see what we're remedying. But that's just like a demur. It's only for the purpose of that motion.
Then it would not be a surrogate trial.
No.
Why don't you write the language? Because then we can get that right.
I don't have a copy of the California provision. What it does is you start out with your 30-day demand notice for a restitutionary cure or for a remedy on behalf of yourself and the class. Proceeds to the next point is instructs in effect the alleged violator to attempt to do certain things. Ascertain class members. Notify them that you will take the steps necessary to effect restoration or restitution of any nature that will remedy them for the deceptive practice. At that point, if you comply with those things, and the court can in an action, it then puts it on the plaintiff. If he feels that you have not complied with it, he can go ahead and proceed with his lawsuit for damages. And there's a very important distinction here, tracing back a little bit, it provides no class action be maintained for damages, or however, you can bring an action for injunctive relief alone. I'd also like to point out this is a class action bill that we opposed in California last year. At that point, they're in a substantially different form than it originated. At that point, there's a provision in there that any attempt to comply with the restitutionary, to make a restitutionary offer by the alleged violator is not an out-of-court admission, and it's not, and it is inadmissible in evidence as an offer to compromise under the California Evidence Code, except for purposes of showing bona fide in connection with the bona fide defense section in the California Act. The plaintiff is then at the risk of, it must make the decision as to whether the restitutionary cure is proper or not. He can then file a suit or not file it depending upon his determination. If he is wrong and he files the suit, the fact that the alleged violator has performed an appropriate restitutionary cure in the eyes of the court is a defense, or would be in the nature of a defense, since it would cut off the right to class action. As to the substance of the California Act.
It seems to me that this has some analogy to preliminary hearing in a criminal case,
yeah.
In which the defendant, usually is off his rocker if he says anything. And that's what I'm saying here is aren't you, if you put on any evidence in that preliminary hearing, is this going to be used against you in the trial?
I question.
Or what the determination is.
I tend to agree with you because I feel that the part in here about that the alleged violations were not intentional and result from bona fide error, notwithstanding the use of reasonable procedures adapted to avoid such error, it raises questions of fact relating to the case as opposed to the merit of the restitutionary offer.
Dave, do any objection to talking to you at all? Entirely.
No, I wouldn't have any objection. I would see this as a first step is that the company has made a settlement offer which has been rejected by the class plaintiffs. Then he comes into court at this preliminary hearing and would like to reassert that settlement offer primarily based on his belief that any act that did occur was unintentional on his part. And so he's trying to force the plaintiff class to accept the settlement partly ever get to this stage, but because he's already given them notice. Now you're in court, and he's trying to say that was a reasonable settlement offer, primarily because I had no knowledge as to what was going on. I don't see how he's injured because he's not making admissions. Well, he
was supposing.
Well, that's, I mean, I have no objection to the fact he's still in
Ireland
and just stating that that the defense, that it, just picking up the entire language from previously, it, say, it shall be a defense that the alleged violations were not intentional as only one part error.
Well, I think that when you have that prior language, it's the defense is there. The point here is to encourage either an intentional or non-intentional violator of the act to perform without going through the process of litigation, without going through the long drawn-out battle. So you have to have something at the other end, something that will encourage the defendant to make an offer and cause the plaintiffs to seriously consider it, other than the attorney's fees section. In the nature of what you have in C, but without going to merits. This is why the California provision, when I was talking to Dave earlier, as I said, that in this type of thing, much prefer the California thing. This is one of the reasons, because it has that type of built-in mechanism in it that would offer a greater protection. However, I would again reiterate that my comments are suggested as technical, because we, again, are imposed quite so.
Dave, my suggestion, maybe we might go ahead and meanwhile Dave can try and have the language that does this. I think it's,
would that be federal?
Sure.
All right, I think you understand what we're doing on class action, and the next thing is we've read you the provision of number 7 on attorney fees, which you have on the print, on the amendments that are not pasted in.
Don't we need a 6 in here someplace down?
Because
you got here.
6 is, 3 is, 3 should be crossed out and 6 inserted. It's also part of the
page 7, line 15.
3 should
become
line 15.
That's 6.
Where are we now? Pull this up. Line 6.
That was the reason.
All right, then the question we had said, so I guess the next thing down is line 28 of page 7. We had said actions brought under the section shall be commenced within 1 year from the discovery of the unlawful method, act, or practice. I think this is a mistake, because that discovery might be 25 years hence. And so the problem is to get some kind of limitation on that. We have suggested 2 years from the discovery. I said 2 because that's our normal tort statute in Oregon. 2 years from discovery, and then we've added the language suggested by, and it's or from the time when a reasonable man should have discovered the unlawful method, act, or practice, which puts some terminal point on it. Prentice favored the continuation of the 1 year provision. I suggested 2 because that's our normal, the normal statute in other tort actions. Then the next one is on page 8, the top of the page. We're indebted to Prentice for again aiding consumers on this one, where unless we added the words action brought by the assignee, we're allowing the holder in due course to have be in a better position than the seller. What this is about is Oregon in tort statute 2 years, the contract statute is 6 years. And this means that at any time that the seller sues the buyer, after the 2 year period, before the 6 year period, the buyer may assert any rights that he otherwise would have.
Any questions?
I got no question.
Okay.
All right, the next one appears on page 8, line 21. This goes to one of Brendan's suggestions, which I had hoped was implicit, but this makes it explicit. The problem, this whole section deals with the so-called investigative demand, where the prosecuting attorney is requiring the company to produce documents and other testimony, similar to a deposition in a civil case. The question arises, suppose the material that is sought to be reached is a trade secret or is a confidential material in some way which might be of use to competitors, and the company wants to say that they will not disclose that information. They've got a right to present that to the court before they're forced to produce anything, and the court can decide whether they should be required to produce it or not. And the court has a variety of normal techniques for deciding what to do. Sometimes the court itself looks at it before it shows it to the other side, and there are many techniques. But I think that's what that one's about.
Okay.
All right, then, page 9, the top line, credit subjected to such services, circuit court may direct and move personal service in the state, I think primarily because it's awful vague, and if you leave that out, you just have your... Yeah. If you leave it out, you have the normal techniques of substitute service. But if you add that, you've got the circuit court saying, well, I decided it and write him a letter. And that's basically what you're... If you cross out 4 and leave 1, 2, and 3, you're essentially leaving the present law. We agree on section 14B, commencing on line 11, that revoking the charter to do business is too extreme a remedy for failure to comply with investigative demand. The proper method is the normal contempt power of the court, which is left in. If a person doesn't produce what he's supposed to produce, the court can hold him in contempt like he can in any other proceeding. All right, then on the next page, section 16, here again, Dave and I thought this was implicit, but we're making it explicit by adding on line 4 and also line 11 the words willfully. Now this refers to here a person is either, an injunction against them in one, or they have agreed voluntarily to an agreement not to do something, and they violate the injunction or violate the assurance they've given. And we agree that before these fairly major penalties are invoked, that violation must be willful. As if they break the court order, the court can throw the book at them if they do it willfully. All right, then, I think the 4 on line 19 is technical.
At this point, if I might interrupt.
I'm sorry, yes.
I would like to suggest an amendment at this time.
Yes.
Which on this production, is number 21 on the third page, that's your terminal facts. The third page.
I think
that, Madam Chairman, is the wrong page. It's a one paragraph page. No, the thermal facts are stapled together. Actually two enclosures. If you'll get to the start, the first three pages is the first enclosure and then the secondary enclosure. Okay, number 21. And this is an amendment that is from my little FTC Act, and I understand and been told by numerous people that this is against the tradition that exists in the state of Oregon, and contrary to what the District Attorney's Association believes, but it is our suggested language that the Attorney General primarily have prior approval of district attorney's actions, and that in conjunction with the provisions of 1088, as I indicated back initially, we are very much in favor of the Consumer Protection Division in the Attorney General's office. And in that connection, we feel that centralized coverage and enforcement of deceptive trade practice is essential in order to provide a realistic deterrent effect toward deceitful business. In this regard, with decentralized enforcement, you have, let's say that you have a violation by-night operator up in the northeast corner of Oregon. District attorney hears about it and starts investigating. The guy goes down to the southeast corner of Oregon, and he move around from county to county, from district attorney to district attorney. Yet if you have centralized enforcement, when the acts are committed up in northeast Oregon, it comes to the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division, and he can reach out when the person is now in southeast Oregon. So that to really have effective enforcement, effective public enforcement, it just seems to me that you have to have the centralized power in the Attorney General's office. And therefore, our amendment is going on.
This is one that I think would not be realistic in Oregon. Not only have the district attorneys traditionally been very jealous of their right to proceed in all matters that might be within their jurisdiction without the prior approval of the Attorney General, but typically the home counties have been equally vehement that they wanted to keep their power. This matter has come up many times when I've been in the legislature where essentially some of the eastern Oregon counties have said that they want their district attorney to set the standards for law enforcement in their county. And in many states, the Attorney General, maybe California, I don't know, many states, the Attorney General is the supervisor of the district attorneys, and they essentially work for them in criminal law enforcement. In this state, every time that matter is faintly suggested, they start coming over from across the pass, and that's the last that it's heard of. I think, though I respect the way that what Prentice is saying, I think that in terms of the way this act would have to work in terms of Oregon traditions, that we'd have to continue this joint ability to proceed. However, there are limitations because district attorney must make full report to the attorney general, file copies of things with the attorney general. So I think it will work out as a practical matter without changing 111 years of methods of proceeding.
I have yet to be convinced that you can go to that a part-time district attorney could effectively enforce this act. I understand there are such animals.
Don't be arguing out of me. I just want to pass the bill.
I think it's bad tradition.
Well, now, clarify in my mind now, basically, the way the law is written, the way we've suggested it, either one can take all the action. In other words, the Attorney General can still do everything you're saying it's doing, even though the local district attorney also has the option of carrying the ball.
Right. Right.
So why? What's the objection?
I just think that your deterrent effect of the thing is going to be better if you have
one guy. In other words, they can't pass the buck as much. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's partly it. And also, you're going to get more national exposure from more aggressive attorney general enforcement than with local county enforcement. And this is the type of thing which is going to discourage deceptive practitioners from coming to the state.
So if they've got a gung-ho attorney general, can't he go ahead and do anything that you want him to do?
Yeah, if he had the funding, if he had the staff, if he had the equipment, That's one of the reasons we like the Attorney General's bill. They create the division, they have a separate appropriations bill. No, I think that their section is the same as this one, and you'll notice in our suggested amendments to 1088, we make the same suggestion that we make here, that the parallel provision be changed. Many of our amendments, in fact, where the provisions are the same, we're suggesting consistent language between the two bills.
How is the attitude of the chief attorneys on the rest of the round state? Are they going to be gun told and shake these guys down and prosecute?
What really bothers me about his is that he directs a district attorney to act as long as you've got a murder and a false advertising all the time since he put in the murder. That has to be. So that's the way they feel, and I know that from working in the district attorney's office, that they're very well intended. They do have a very heavy burden. The official position of the district attorney's office was that they were in favor. At that time, the only bill they were aware of was House Bill 1088. They were in favor of House Bill 1088 with the substitution of the word prosecuting attorney for substitution of the word district attorney for prosecuting attorney. They liked all the substantive provisions, and that was a divided vote. I think there are, particularly from your major counties, urban counties, there's a feeling that the Attorney General has the right and should participate in this program.
In other words, the present law, which I wrote in 1965, that this was county enforcement. That's what it's been since 65. This bill gives the Attorney General the authority to enforce, in addition to district attorney enforcement. My feeling is that's as far as we're going to be able to go without taking away from the district attorney the right to see our own.
Both
can act under this bill. Both can act, and I think it's going to be particularly important in terms of what financing is available. We want the district attorney to be able to proceed, but with the benefit of reporting to the AG, so I think there will be some more action.
I'd buy that.
What's the attorney general act in the county? Is he going to make the district attorney there
as a practical matter, if I was the Attorney General, I would call up a district attorney in a county and just bill pass and said, here's such and such going on. Who's going to take him on? You and me. And I've got a big staff, and I can take him on, but if you wish, you go to it. And I think in many cases, if the DA in smaller counties can say, I'm busy prosecuting first-degree murder charge, bless you, come on in. In the case of some of the larger counties where they're set up for it, they may say, no, we can handle this. We appreciate the tip. It's going to vary. I would think it would jeopardize the bill if we wipe the district attorney out of the bill.
No, I'm happy. I don't think that I'm proposing to wipe the district attorney out of the bill.
Make elected officials give assistance to another elected official.
Well, and another concern in relation to prior approval language, it seems to me that you just hit the nail on the head. You're talking about elected officials imposing how many counties are between here and Portland. And don't we get the Portland newspapers here? And it's posing as an advertising practice that couldn't each DA bring the action prior approval of the Attorney General to bring the action in force violation in 9, 10, 12 counties?
The answer is they could, but they've had that right for the past 5 years, and our problem has not been too much enforcement, but too little. Anyway, my suggestion would go on. I don't think.
Okay, that's
just two more things. First of all, Dave and I both suggest that the criminal penalty be taken out. This is the sales below cost in the day. Neither Dave nor I believe that criminal penalties are an appropriate method for enforcing the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. That's been my philosophy over the years that Bill's been before our legislature.
There's one other provision which has never been used, and that's the little Patton-Robinson Act, which is a discrimination between suppliers, which is 646-010-080, and there has been no activity in that by any district attorney that I'm aware of, and that would
1967 by inadvertence, Gracie Pack put through an amendment to add a provision for blind people and had a criminal penalty in there inadvertently, which became law, so I put a bill through later in that same session to repeal the criminal penalty. So it became consistent. The only final one we have, Madam Chairman, is Dave has written some language back on the class action thing, which we think solves.
Remember,
one, two, three, four, five, six, and seven.
So I think you'll find you're renumbering 2, 3, and 4 to 1, 2, and 3. But you'll hold 3, 4 and 8.
2, 3, and 4. 1, 2, 3. And then the final thing is Dave has written some language which we think that the problem of the admissions made at the preliminary hearing. And this would go at the end of number C on the big insert. Yes, additional language. Admissions made by the defendant at the preliminary hearing provided under subsection C of this section are for the purposes of the hearing only and may not be used at the time of trial of the issues. Is that a D or would that be a additional language, Dave?
It could be made a D.
Anyway, this what you have here is the product of some long hard work since we last met, and if the chairman wants a motion, I'm prepared to move in.
Well,
it's
okay for the discussion. Sure. Please satisfy the members of the committee, satisfying their questions.
I think we come back to only one standing difference between you two, and apparently then this class action thing, and I don't know that I know all there is in the law. No, I know very little about it, except what I've heard of the discussion on this thing. First thing, a political question. Is this going to jeopardize the passage of what might otherwise be an excellent bill?
In my opinion, no.
The other thing, is the class action provisions, as they've been modified in their discussion today, is this, would you characterize this as being substantially more restrictive than what's been passed in other states and other areas, or is it about the same, or where does it lie in the whole class action picture?
I would say roughly, Dave, get that account, I would say roughly parallel. It's shorter, I think, than California. Is that accurate, Dave?
I would say it's, I would say it was slightly more, it's slightly more favorable to the plaintiff than California, and probably as parallel or a little stronger than Massachusetts, and I think North Carolina is probably more liberal than we are. So we can't be labeled anywhere, really. At least I don't think that. I think that would be fair. We're more in the middle than anything else.
Are there just three states that have this now?
There are so many before legislatures at this time that this is an exploding issue.
This essential proposal is being considered everywhere.
Well, I recognize this. I've read the national legislation and the thing, but I want to fit it in with what has been done already. You always feel much safer, at least I do, if someone else has tried this thing out and found that, well, it didn't provide all the problems that have been indicated for class action.
Please talk about this. On discussion, on this class action thing. The reason why I think this is important, and why it's in the FTC and all these other model acts who themselves give it a good deal of thought, is that there's only one attorney general, only a limited number of district attorneys who have time to do this, and you can't expect government to do everything. You asked some of these witnesses that Legal Aid brought the other day, essentially, what would this bill do to improve your situation? Part of the answer is better definitions, but actually, the existing definitions, though cruder, would probably have caused those fairly gross frauds. But this allows private people to protect themselves without having government do all the protecting for them. Now, even though you provide for a $200 minimum penalty for the individual suit, there are not many individuals who are taken, who are going to take the trouble to hire a lawyer to collect that $200. So that's a remedy that has somebody. People may go on a small claims court. Occasionally there will be somebody who will say, by God, it's a matter of principle. But even the $200 really isn't going to convince them to really go after them. On the other hand, if you can get a situation where there are a number of frauds, we're postulating fraud for the moment. If they're not fraud, they're defense. Assuming fraud, if you can put them together in this class suit with all the procedural safeguards we have here to prevent abuse, then you've got a real way of getting restitution for people who are taken. And that's why not only is this in all the state bills, but either the first or second priority of the Consumer Federation of America on a national level is a bill sponsored by Senator Magnuson in Washington, which essentially provides a class action mechanism in federal court on the theory that the most important thing in this whole area is the remedies. Mm-hmm. I'll make my little pitch for why I think it's important.
Okay, any other comments?
Quite a parliamentary inquiry. Since Senator Burns is out of the telephone committee, let's take that bill out of the committee.
Senator Burns is not a lame man.
He is not.
No.
He is just a... What kind of member is he? I see he's written himself on two committees of the state federal
affairs. Brilliant.
He's on my committee on environment. I went and asked him the same question. He said that I'm an alternate member, which means I want to focus attention on the work of these three new committees, environmental affairs, consumer affairs, and criminal law and procedure, but I'm not a voting member.
I don't think
he'll
go on the committee
with him. Yeah, well, I was curious to know whether it takes forward a vote of anything on it or change anything or thereby.
Okay, Don, why don't you
move? I move that the amendments that I propose be made a part of the bill. And that includes the amendments that are pasted in, plus, well, it really includes this, but this is what you have in front of you.
Plus the one that Dave just added.
And plus the one that Dave just added. This is an exact copy of this, but there's one additional one that's in here that for some reason was not pasted in, which is that to that. Limiting the attorney's fees in the individual situation.
Madam Chairman, may I ask Larry about a question on this? Basically, you agreed on most of the amendments, I assume. Either agreed or my objections were substantially nullified. I'm not going to go through them again on these other amendments. Some of them he answered my objection indirectly, and in other cases directly. And as you know, we went through most of the same points we went through last week, and in all the cases, the situation is more balanced. Our primary objection now is, again, the class action provision. Madam Chairman, I would move to amend Don's motion and delete the class action section.
Yeah.
changes in the statute. I think there's a good deal of impetus for a good consumer bill based on the national FTC model, which is all very informed, county state government essential model. I would think this is the session to pass a good bill. I think it would weaken it substantially because it really deprives individual citizens from a meaningful, effective remedy. It would provide a better statute for the public officials. But public officials are never going to be able to do the job in this area by having 150 assistant attorney general. And if you agree with the theory as I do, that we should encourage and provide techniques for private persons to defend their rights, our own rights. And if we agree, and there's not much disagreement on the suit by the individual plaintiff, the one at a time, then I think that a realistic appraisal would be that the individual plaintiff suit, in most cases, is relatively meaningless, unless
getting at an ease of definition and as few elements as possible in the crime rather than the severity of the punishment. I know that based on information I've heard, I know Senator White, last session legislature, some of the, here again I'm not talking about the public building kind.